So, I'm very delighted to welcome Chris Moore Backman, author of this book over here, The Gandhian Iceberg, Nonviolence Manifesto for the Age of the Great Turning, Too Many Rivers, Books, and Tea. I know he has connections here in Sonoma County, and but now lives up. I don't know if he had to evacuate for the...
We welcome the evacuees.
Okay. Up about the in the Oroville area a few weeks ago, but I am delighted to hear of his work. Some of the people in this audience apprise me of your work, so you have good friends here, and at the conclusion of this talk, I dare say many more. So please join me in welcoming Chris Moore Backman to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
It's wonderful to be here. Wonderful just to walk in off the street into this space. It feels really good to be in here. Jean, thank you for making this happen. This was the wonderful friend who introduced you all, I'm pretty sure, to my book, and I'm really grateful for that, Jean. Awesome to see old friends tonight, and also to see new friends that I haven't met yet. I'm hoping you'll all join me in just sharing a few moments of quiet before I begin. And I asked my dear friend Carisha if she would grace us with a little bit of music with her wonderful voice that will kind of begin us. So whenever you feel called to sing out of the silence, Carisha, we'll just be waiting with you.
Shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round attending fire. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we try. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now, and what a time to be alive. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love.
What a time to be alive. Thank you, Karisha. Thank you all for coming out tonight to listen a little bit about this book I've written. And it's the culmination of this little more than 20 years of journeying with Gandhi in various ways. And my hope tonight is to give you a taste of what's in this book. And I'll just say right off the top that writing it and taking to the road to some extent to share with people about it, I have a couple of goals in mind. The main one is actually I'm working as a recruiter. I say in the preface to the book that the book is written for really anyone who'll take an interest in it, but with a specific hope that folks who feel a deep resonance with this approach to social change, the approach that I and a handful of other people see in the work of Gandhi and what he taught and what he modeled. For those of us who feel a deep resonance, we're trying to get our little team together with the understanding that we live in a time when social movements all over the nation and the world are beginning to find one another and to knit themselves together in what many of us are calling MOM. It's an acronym for the Movement of Movements. And the hypothesis that's the motivation for this book is that those of us who feel a deep sense of call to live into and to live out a comprehensive, holistic approach to nonviolence, a nonviolence that's not simply a tactical choice to not use physical force in situations of conflict, that's just a shadow of the nonviolence we're talking about, but a nonviolence that is a way of life, a comprehensive approach to our lives in service to this thing many of us are calling the Great Turning. Joanna Macy is popularizing that phrase, the Great Turning, and she says that it represents the shift. She likens it to an epochal shift, as monumental as the agrarian revolution or the industrial revolution, an epochal shift from our industrial growth society with its plunder of the earth and its plunder of poor people throughout the world, most of whom are people of color, with the extraction that it depends on of resources from the earth, a shift from that system to a truly just and life-sustaining society. So that Great Turning is what we seek to serve, and the means we want to use have everything to do with this approach to nonviolence that we see modeled by Gandhi. So I'm recruiting folks who feel a deep resonance with that and want to join that team, who are part of the team but we just haven't met yet. Because we feel that we have an essential, special role to play within that larger movement ecology, that larger movement of movements. We're not entering into that movement with an attitude of, we've got the answer, this is the way we're going to do things. We're moving into it in a spirit of service, saying we feel that we have a special gift to offer. We want to bring that gift, recognizing that all of these other sub-movements of the larger movement of movements have their own gift to bring as well. For me personally, I've had a sense in recent years, especially as we've come to learn more and more about the crisis to do with the climate, overarching crisis under which all of these other social crises sit. The more I've learned about that, the more I've felt that those of us who have committed ourselves to a disciplined, comprehensive approach to nonviolence have failed horribly to bring our gift. And now's the time for us to show up and bring it. So I just want to be transparent about that. I'm a recruiter, one of a small number who's looking for fellow teammates. In addition to that, I also think that the book captures a lot of really helpful information about what Gandhi actually taught and did. So even for those who don't feel like they want to be part of this sub-movement, I feel like can gain a lot from reading this book, especially if they do so alongside other interpretations of Gandhi, to try to make sense of what this particular teacher left behind. I want to say at the beginning, since we're only going to have an hour and a little more perhaps together, that I'm not into hagiography. I'm not trying to make a saint out of Gandhi in the book or when I talk. I have no need or desire to rescue Gandhi from the various critiques about him, his weaknesses, his mistakes, many of which he admitted and many of which he never seemed to see. Gandhi for me is a mixed bag. And we could spend a lot of time looking at the shadow side of what he brought, but I'm choosing tonight and for the most part in the book to focus on the gifts he brought, because I think we can make use of them in really positive ways. Looking at the shadow side, I believe, does have value for us, but not so much to knock Gandhi down, but for us to learn about the living of our own lives. through his mistakes, right? And that's my hope in speaking with you and being with you tonight, is that we'll all gain something in terms of figuring out how we can live our own lives better, how we can bring our gifts more fully into the world. So, let's talk a little bit about the book. To do so, I want to start by letting Gandhi say a little bit to us. I'm going to read a short passage from an article that he wrote in 1930 that I include in the introduction to the book. For those who haven't read it, let me just give a little bit of context. 1930, it was March when Gandhi and 78 of his fellow ashramites from Satyagraha Ashram set out on the Salt March, arguably the most pivotal campaign in the independence struggle. A lot of people don't know that just prior to that, on New Year's Day, 1930, the Indian National Congress, which was really the engine for the independence movement in terms of organizing, did a really creative and interesting thing. This was 16 years prior to independence, okay, so we keep that in mind. But on New Year's Day that year, they invited all of India to pretend that they were free, to celebrate Independence Day as a way of coming into some experience of what that would feel like. It's a really powerful image to conjure up, right? So they had this Independence Day celebration, which got the juices flowing, and then, as the Indian National Congress sometimes did, they turned to Gandhi and said, now come up with a strategy for massive civil disobedience across the whole nation. Come up with a strategy for us. To which Gandhi responded by going on retreat, basically. For a few weeks, he went on a personal retreat within the ashram, in his own room. He began to settle into silence and prayer, and to seek, he said, he was listening for the inner voice, and the Salt March was what came to him. So, as he came out of that retreat period, he began to write articles to introduce the nation to the idea of this Salt March. The article I'm going to read now is one of the articles in a series of articles that he published to educate the nation about what was about to happen. So this is February 27th, 1930, 2 weeks before the march would begin. He says, "So far as I'm concerned, my intention is to start the movement only through the inmates of the ashram and those who have submitted to its discipline and assimilated the spirit of its methods. Those, therefore, who will offer battle at the very commencement will be unknown to fame. The ashram has been deliberately kept in reserve in order that by a fairly long course of discipline it might acquire stability. I feel that if the Satyagraha ashram," and Satyagraha, we'll talk about this word in a minute, but we can translate it for now as nonviolent resistance. "If Satyagraha ashram is to deserve the great confidence that has been reposed in it and the affection lavished upon it by friends, the time has arrived for it to demonstrate the qualities implied in the word Satyagraha. I feel that our self-imposed restraints have become subtle indulgences, and the prestige acquired has provided us with privileges and conveniences of which we may be utterly unworthy. These have been thankfully accepted in the hope that someday we would be able to give a good account of ourselves in terms of Satyagraha. And if at the end of nearly 15 years of its existence, the ashram cannot give such a demonstration, it and I should disappear. And it would be well for the nation, the ashram, and me." So, just to unpack this a little bit, since you don't have it in front of you, Gandhi's saying that after a period of 15 years, he and what turned out to be 78 chosen members of the ashram were going to step out for this campaign at the invitation of the Indian National Congress to demonstrate for the nation what nonviolent resistance actually is. So I want to place this in the context of my own journey with Gandhi. I discovered this paragraph in 2003, I'm guessing sometime in April. And the reason I make that guess is because, as many of us will remember, 2003 in February was when the invasion of Iraq happened. February 16th was the day in San Francisco when we took to the streets. I'm just curious if any of us, any others in here were there that day.
Maybe not in the city, but it's somewhere.
Yeah. February 16th, 2003, that's the day it happened there. But a few days prior, a few days after, it was happening all over the globe, as we remember. My experience that day was a mixture of exhilaration, knowing that millions of people all over the world were saying no in unison to what was about to happen, and at the same time having this pit in my stomach, knowing it was going to happen anyway. I had been studying Gandhi for about 10 years, closely, more or less, up until that point. And as I marched with my friends that day, I remember seeing different signs that had little Gandhiisms on it, you know? And I was just with this question of how was it that millions of people all over the world were saying no to this with such a unified voice and yet wasn't going to change it? And my intuition was just tugging at me, and it was saying, you need to figure out what gave Gandhi's movement the depth that you're not experiencing in this movement now. For all the study I had done up to that point, I still didn't feel like I understood what it was that gave the Indian movement that kind of depth that I knew wasn't happening. I dove even more deeply into my study, and it was shortly after that that I found this paragraph, and I just had an aha moment. 78 people, 50 years of preparation, 15 years of preparation. That group forming the nucleus of the Salt March. What I witnessed in San Francisco had nothing of the sort. There might have been a handful of us who were dedicated to that depth of nonviolence, but we were just scattered throughout the crowd. But 78 that had actually lived together in community and practiced together, trained together for 15 years. So I'm just going to write a few things up here.
You're okay.
So just this series of numbers, 78 and 15. Shortly after I discovered this article, a friend of mine, Joanne Sheehan of the War Resisters League, reached out to me knowing my interest in Gandhi, and she said, hey, a friend of mine and I are beginning to do a series of workshops out here in New England, and we're using a model that Gene Sharp and Robert Burrows put forward in the 70s and 80s, respectively. And it goes like this. It's a three-part model. So I'm going to add a third number here to our little series. These are the numbers that kind of rock my world. She said there's a three-part description that these Gandhi scholars have come up with to describe what it was that Gandhi was busy with throughout his career and what it was that characterized those 15 years for the members of his community. And the three parts I began to use in my own workshops by way of a Venn diagram. And these three parts of the Gandhian approach are basically the outline of my book. The first part is self-transformation. The second part is constructive program. And the third part is Satyagraha. And we'll get to the kind of depth of meaning in that word, but again, let's just think of it for now as nonviolent resistance. So these are three different dimensions of the Gandhian approach. Self-transformation, just really quickly, we can think of this as the work of aligning principle and practice. at the personal level. Imagine what that would look like if we actually aligned our behavior, our actions, with our innermost convictions, our innermost sense of why we're on this planet, what it means to be a human being. That's the first dimension. Constructive program is basically building the society we want to inhabit in the shell of the old. So this is the new society in the shell of the old. So this is taking nonviolence out into the community and doing the work of social uplift and renewal that we need to do in order to build that society in which we truly long to live in. Gandhi argued that when we do this work of building the new society in the shell of the old, without a doubt, the forces of empire are going to come knocking on our door. Because those forces do not want to see that new society come into being. When empire comes knocking, nonviolent resistance becomes necessary. It's not that Gandhi never initiated nonviolent resistance. The Salt March is actually an occasion when he did initiate something. But usually, nonviolent resistance came about when empire was putting obstacles in front of constructive programs. Okay, so again, this is nonviolent resistance. Okay, so when Joanne showed me this model, I had another aha moment, and I sort of deconstructed the Salt March. From the very beginning, when Gandhi started writing his articles in Harijan, his national publication, from the very beginning, he described the march as a sacred pilgrimage. And in letting folks know that it would be started with members of the ashram, this group of 78, he was letting the nation also know that they were going to bring their spinning wheels with them to continue their daily practice of spinning cotton, which was a hallmark of the constructive program. We'll talk about that also in just a sec. They were going to hold morning and evening prayer as they did in their day-to-day life within the ashram. So it was really going to be an ashram on the road, a spiritual community on the road. The practices of self-transformation would go with them as they marched. The Salt March, part of the reason Gandhi chose salt was constructive program. Dance break? Constructive program.
Sorry about this. It's gone now.
It's gone, all right.
Shut it off.
I never get close. I get about one.
You have the secret mallet back there, right? The next one that goes off, I'm going to go Gandhi all over it. So the Salt March was all about reclaiming an indigenous industry that had been monopolized by the empire. It was a concrete expression of constructive program where they were literally manufacturing and distributing salt, a needed nutrient for the people that the British were making illegal for the Indian people to manufacture and distribute. Even the poorest of the poor who lived right next to the seashore, against the law, for them to harvest salt from their own motherland, right? This is constructive program. Right, reclamation, concrete, of what's been lost. And then obviously when Gandhi lifts that handful of salt above his head, he sets off national civil disobedience across the entire country. Mm-hmm. So what I began to see was, in the Salt March, this spot, this sweet spot, right? That power spot for a Venn diagram where all three of those meet. That's the Salt March. And then, I'm holding that in one hand, and I think about February 16, 2003, San Francisco in this hand. And I began to realize the difference between what I was seeing in my own U.S. context and what we were doing as activists versus what Gandhi was doing. And I began to get a feeling like, okay, I'm getting it now, where that depth really came from. It was this comprehensive, holistic view of what nonviolence actually was, what its potential power was. Any questions to sort of clarify any of this language? Yeah.
Mine is just an observation, and that is that Martin Luther King didn't do that. He didn't have 78 people that lived together for 15 years and trained, and yet he accomplished an enormous social transformation. So I just wanted to say that.
Amen. And it's interesting because when I discovered this, shortly after that, I decided to turn my attention to the U.S., and I studied the African American freedom movement through this lens. And he didn't have a period of 15 years of training with a group of 78, but all three of these were very much at play. And it's a beautiful exercise to seek them and find them. We consider this deep spirituality of the Black Church, and the way the music and the language of resistance that young people had as they carried forth that work. The self-transformation was deep, constructive program as well. There was a lot going on with the freedom schools, citizenship schools that were being run, lots of other things. And then obviously nonviolent resistance, that was Dr. King's, I think, biggest strength. But the movement had all three at play. I appreciate you bringing that up. The Gandhi model, the 78-15-3, that's just one model, right? It's not the only way to depth, but it's the one that I got turned on to. Yes?
I just want to piggyback because I'm just learning about many of those leaders actually did come together and live in a Christian pacifist community. James Farmer, who started the war, lived in a Christian pacifist community. And so some of we just didn't learn about that.
Yeah. And the Highlander Folk School was not an ashram, but it was a place that many of those leaders went through. And it was like a revolving door of powerful leadership, right? Maybe my next book will be about the Kingian iceberg.
When you say you knew that the movement against the war was going to fail, and that was because we hadn't done the background, I mean, you know, the thousands of people that were in those marches and so forth had been part of various movements for very many years, you know, since the Vietnam War, for instance.
I agree with that. My experience, and again, this was my intuitive experience on that day. I just had that feeling in my stomach, and it was undeniable that the war was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's not a criticism against any particular group that was out there pounding the pavement. I was out there too. Lots of us had done a lot of amazing work, but I did, when I discovered this, realize that this was different, to have that level of intentionality and training over that long of a period before setting out. I just began to see, like, how could that not lend a depth to that movement that we haven't experienced here? The civil rights chapter of the African American freedom struggle being the closest thing, I think, that we've seen. I want to keep going just for time, but keep whatever other comments and questions you might have. So with that model, eventually, I began to use an iceberg instead of the Venn diagram. It kind of looks like a molar, right? Anyways, you know that the metaphor of the iceberg, usually this would be the tip of the iceberg and this, you know, the bigger foundational part under the water. I play with that a little bit in my model so that I can have all three parts. So this down here is the self-transformation. This would be constructive program, and then I call this the tip of the iceberg, and that's satyagraha. So it's really the tip of the iceberg. The reason I started using the iceberg instead of the Venn diagram is that the Venn diagram gives this impression that those things just overlap, whereas the iceberg shows this is all one big chunk of ice. It's indivisible, completely indivisible. But even still, this doesn't quite work. It's close enough that I wrote a book using it, but it's not quite there. And the reason I say that is that the whole thing is self-transformation, right? when we do the work of satyagraha, when we actually go out and face and engage with empire, the ways that it seeks to demean our humanity, in whatever way we seek to engage with that, to stand up to that, that is self-transformative in my experience and many others. Constructive program, the work that we do to build the new society in the shell of the old, this transforms us as well, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which the whole thing is self-transformation. I play around with this a little bit in the book to say, let's just picture that the water line, you know, changes. This thing moves up and down. Sometimes it goes all the way up and the whole iceberg goes down in self-transformation, right? So, mm-hmm. It's all indivisible. It's all of a piece, and I have a feeling that if were Gandhi alive today, he would laugh at this and say, don't try to compartmentalize it at all. Don't bother with that. He was not a compartmentalist. Okay, so I want to just say a few words about the ice itself in the iceberg. Welcome. I had the opportunity when I was working on my master's project to interview 6 veterans of the African American freedom movement. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. One of the people that I interviewed was Ruby Sales, who's an amazing freedom fighter. As a teenager, worked with SNCC in the Deep South in Lowndes County. There's so much I could say about that interview, but the piece that I want to bring out is she talked about what she called a language of resistance, a vocabulary of resistance. She said that the young people who set out on the Freedom Rides, for example, or the sit-in movement, so many of them shared a vocabulary of resistance. A lot of those young people heard that vocabulary in the songs they sang in church. They heard it in the sermons and speeches of Dr. King when he melded words from the prophets in the Old Testament with language from our own Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, this weaving of all this powerful language. She was saying that language of resistance, that vocabulary of resistance, was the solid ground on which we stood as we carried out the struggle. So when I heard that, I began to think back to what I learned about the Indian movement, and I realized, wow, there was a really amazing vocabulary of resistance in that movement as well. And I want to just share a handful of words with you that were part of the vocabulary of resistance and what I've come to see as the essence of the ice itself. Okay, meaning that all three of these things have a lot to do with these words. We'll start with ahimsa, which is the word that's translated usually as nonviolence. I mentioned at the beginning, in one form or another, I mentioned that the going definition of nonviolence, sort of out in society, is it's the tactical choice to not use physical force in situations of conflict. That's how most people speak of nonviolence, and they usually use a hyphen in there for nonviolence. Lest we forget, for Gandhi, ahimsa, nonviolence, was the most powerful force in the universe. It's a very different baseline understanding of what this is. The most powerful force in the universe, he said it was invincible. It could not be subject to defeat. So Gandhi's talking about something different than what the average U.S. person or even U.S. activist is talking about. If we're talking about the most powerful force in the universe, which is invincible and not subject to defeat. For Gandhi, that's what nonviolence was. I already mentioned this word satyagraha. This Gandhi coined himself because he was tired of this phrase passive resistance, which folks were using to describe what he was doing in South Africa. And he said, there's nothing passive about what's happening here. We need a better word for this.
So he actually had a contest. In his paper, he wrote a little article and said, we're looking for a better phrase or word to describe this new force that we're, you know, working with. It was actually his nephew who suggested satagraha. Sada meaning service. Graha meaning to cling to or adhere to, or that force of clinging. So it would have been something like clinging to service or the strength of service. Gandhi liked that, but true to form, he did his sort of one-upmanship thing, so I could do better than that. And it's called satyagraha. Satya meaning truth, which in Sanskrit is synonymous with soul. So, soul force is one of the translations. Adherence to truth is another one. And it's often used to denote nonviolent resistance. But you can see it's a very multivalent and powerful word, right?
Here's another word from the Indian resistance lexicon, Swaraj.
Swaraj is the word that folks were using as a label for the movement before Gandhi came on the scene and after Gandhi came on the scene. Swaraj means self-rule or home rule. Before Gandhi came on the scene, the word meant home rule in the sense of political liberty, independence from Britain. That was the overarching goal that everyone could agree on. Gandhi said, let's think about self-rule differently. Not that we're going to throw out that understanding, but let's think about it as self-rule on the individual sense, in the individual sense. What he said was, as soon as enough individual Indians experience self-rule, meaning the reclamation of the full stature of their humanity, the reclaiming of the dignity that had been forfeited or usurped by the empire. As soon as enough of us experience that, we will become an unoppressible people.
Hello?
And the British will pack up and leave.
Wow.
That's what he said. So he turned Swaraj on its head. Instead of putting the burden of Swaraj onto the nation that's more or less outside of ourselves, he lays it on each and every individual Indian.
Okay. Sarvodaya. It's another really important word within the Indian struggle. So Sarvodaya is what Gandhi said was the goal of the movement. I spoke with a couple hundred high school students this morning at Casa Grande High School in Petaluma. It was really wonderful to do that and to be with them. Yeah, they asked some great questions and had some great answers to my questions. And one of the questions I asked was, what was the goal of the Indian movement? Independence from Britain. They were there, you know, they knew. That's the answer that just about anyone would give, given what we, you know, usually talk about in terms of what Gandhi accomplished or what his movement accomplished. But when Gandhi was asked what the goal of the movement was, he said Sarvodaya. Sarvodaya means the uplift of all beings. The uplift of all beings. I'm reading a book right now called The Soil Will Save Us. And I'm learning how the climate change crisis has everything to do with microscopic little critters in the soil. Like Gandhi has this understanding of the oneness of all life, that what happens to those tiny little critters happens to us. It's playing itself out, right? The uplift of all beings. Then I asked the same kids today, shouldn't call them kids, young men and women, what was the goal of the movement that Dr. King was spokesperson for in our own country? They were all over it. Civil rights, racial equality, desegregation. It was great. But then I reminded them, okay,
or maybe I taught them. What did Dr. King come to in terms of the goal for the movement? If you really look at it.
The beloved community.
Yeah, to build the beloved community. And what was the slogan of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which enunciated another layer of the goal? To redeem the soul of America. You feel the difference in your gut, right? We talk about a civil rights movement, but this was a quest to redeem the soul of America. That's something you give your life to, right? So the same thing here, how we go for the lowest common denominator, it seems like, but that's not what Gandhi and King were doing. And I shouldn't single them out. They were spokespeople for the much larger movement, included so many. I'll just do one more because time is moving as rapidly as it always does. Ends equal means. Ends equal means. The whole Gandhian philosophy hinges on that equation. Without that, the whole thing falls apart. Right there. Gandhi taught that if we want to have outcomes that look like reconciliation, peace, justice, transparency, truth, sustainability, whatever those outcomes are, the means, meaning what we do to achieve those outcomes, need to reflect that. As Dr. King said, the ends are pre-existent in the means. If you want sunflowers, you don't put apple seeds in the ground, right? So that's also part of the vocabulary of resistance in the Indian context, which Dr. King completely borrowed for our own struggle. So this is the content that I'm dealing with in the book. And for the last 10 minutes or so, and then I want to open it up for questions, I want to talk about one other sort of strand. First, though, I want to do one really quick thing. We talked about how this is the work of the assignment of getting our own principles and practice into alignment. Lifelong assignment. I've only worked up to about a C+ so far on that assignment. Constructive program. Okay, this is taking all of these same principles that we're using here, but we're moving out into the community. Gandhi actually came up with a list of 19 specific projects that he wanted the Indian people to get busy with all across the nation, and he called it the constructive program. When he went on speaking tours, he emphasized 5 priorities. And I just invite you to picture, say, 1920 in India, when Gandhi went on the road, thousands of people came out to see him. Let's just imagine what the sound systems were like in 1920 in India, right? Last time I went to a concert, my brother was very sweet. He bought me a ticket to U2 last year in San Jose. If I didn't know the lyrics already, there's no way I would have understood what he was saying. And this is 20, that was 2016. So 1920 in India, Gandhi needed a strategy for communication. So he would lift up his hand when he was teaching constructive program, and he would say, these are the priorities, and he would name them one by one. And then those in the front row would turn to the folks behind them, and they would send it. Wow. All the way to the fringes of the gathering. One big game of telephone. You imagine.
Yeah. Well, like what the movements, the most recent movements have been doing, though.
Same idea. In Occupy, there was a lot of the same old school technology. Anyways, I want to show you. I did this today with the students. You know, invited them to do this with me. We don't have time for that, but
had them pretend they were back in kindergarten, you know, making the turkeys that we made with our... These were the five priorities for Gandhi. And as I put them up here, I invite you to translate for our own time and place. Think about what a constructive program would look like for us if we were able to name one. Khadi. So this is the hand spinning of cotton. Along with the salt, the industry of textiles was also monopolized by the British. So Gandhi said, let's spin our own cotton like we used to, making our own clothes like we used to. It became the informal uniform of the movement. The uplift of women. For all the complexity of Gandhi's relationship with women, there's no arguing that he was way ahead of his time in putting this as one of the five priorities. At that time in India, it was unheard of. He elevated women to leadership roles within the movement. He called for the end of a lot of discriminatory practices and so forth. So, complicated but ahead of his time both. Sobriety. Gandhi said that alcoholism and the rampant use of opium in India was sapping the spiritual vitality of the people. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, guess who had a monopoly on the alcohol industry?
The British again.
Pretty easy to make the connection, right? And the end of untouchability. So untouchability being, you know, the untouchable caste were the lowest of the low castes in the hierarchical caste system in India. A sickly dehumanizing institution where, you know, kids were raised to believe that if you even touched an untouchable, you would have to wash because of the impurity, that you would be defiled, and so forth. Gandhi said, this has to go. He said, how can we request freedom from the English for their dehumanizing behavior towards us when we're doing this to our own people? How does that work? Hindu-Muslim unity is the last priority. Now remember, these are 5 of 19. But if you read, you know, enough of the histories of the movement, these five are just the constant refrains. The biggest three, if you do the sort of survey of the literature, were Khadi, the end of untouchability, and Hindu-Muslim unity. But I wanted to just do that hand exercise. Today it was really fun to do this with the young students and to ask them. I asked them to give me examples of what our hand should look like. And they were all over it, and they knew the society they want to live into.
What was Khadi again? I'm sorry.
Khadi is hand spinning cotton.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So that could be like
growing
your own cotton, spinning it, turning it into cloth, making the clothing, the whole thing, trying to just reclaim that industry that had been monopolized by the empire. So I just wanted to give you that so you had more of a sense of constructive program. Satyagraha, nonviolent resistance, this is the part that Gandhi, I believe, is most famous for. This is the part that we tend to pay the most attention to. As the great liberator of India through nonviolent means, this gets a lot more press than the other parts. But what I notice is that a lot of people don't know what he said the first principle of Satyagraha was. Gandhi said that for Satyagrahis, that is, practitioners of Satyagraha, nonviolent resistance, soul force, adherence to truth, love in action, the first order of business is to stop cooperating with anything humiliating. In the book I share that I think about often when I think about Satyagraha, those incredible moments as part of our national treasury, when Rosa Parks
those moments when she was deciding what to do. And I've come to think about those moments, that we all have those moments, as Rosa Parks moments. Basically, what Gandhi taught is that the energy of nonviolent struggle, nonviolent movement, comes from our collective effort to stop cooperating with things that are humiliating. And every time any one of us is in a situation where our personhood is being demeaned, and we stand up to that, we're exercising the muscle of nonviolent movement, of nonviolent struggle. The more that we're all doing that in our day-to-day lives, the more powerful we're going to be when we collectively, you know, walk shoulder to shoulder into nonviolent engagement with empire head on. Now, when we have these Rosa Parks moments, terribly few of them will turn into something like Rosa's moment did. We don't know when the next, you know, such unfolding will happen, but it's sort of beside the point. The call is to do this at every opportunity we can muster enough courage and strength to do it. Okay, now I'm going to say what I was going to say before that long segue. There are three concepts I want to sort of touch on by way of closing my comments, and then we can talk a little bit together before we say goodbye. The first is this phrase, integral nonviolence. I just want to flag this for y'all. If you haven't heard this phrase before, it's a phrase that a growing number of us are beginning to use to denote the holistic, comprehensive approach to nonviolence that I've been talking about. So if you hear this phrase, integral nonviolence, it's talking about the whole iceberg. It's meant as a corrective to the conventional understanding of what nonviolence is, which again is not what Gandhi was talking about. It's a tiny part of what Gandhi was talking about. Let's put it that way. Yes, we don't use physical force in situations of conflict because we believe that the means equal the ends. For Gandhi, that was an absolute. He said there are no experiences, there are no occasions when this will be contradicted. So that's what integral nonviolence is. I talk about that in the book quite a bit. The other phrase I want to put up here is one from the subtitle of the book, and what I already mentioned is the phrase that Joanna Macy is popularizing, the Great Turning. I'm putting out there, along with a handful of other folks, the suggestion, the proposal, that our movement of movements chooses this as the overarching visional statement. In the way that Gandhi said Sarvodaya was the goal of the struggle in India, in the way that Dr. King said beloved community, or to redeem the soul of America, was the goal of the struggle that he was spokesperson for, we're arguing that having a clear overarching visional statement, a visional goal like this, will be helpful to glue together the movement of movements. Again, the Great Turning is the epochal shift from our industrial growth, extraction-based society to a truly just and life-sustaining society. It's a goal that we feel all of our current struggles can find their home in, or their home with, right? I'm not overly attached to that, but it's the best one I've heard so far. And I feel like, given especially the climate change clock and how loudly it's ticking in our ears, it's good enough. Start rolling with it. And I love the way you incorporate it into that beautiful song. Yeah, thank you, Carisha. One more, I mentioned this before. MOM, the movement of movements. One quick story about this. I've had the privilege of working with Christian peacemaker teams on their Palestine-based team in Hebron, and
CPT in Hebron, what they do, a lot of what they do is accompanying school children as they pass through the checkpoints to and from school. The checkpoints that are monitored by the IDF, the Israeli Army, and border police as well. And the best gig you can possibly get with CPT in Hebron is to accompany the kindergartners. Palestinian kindergartners who go to this little school that's attached to the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is one of the epicenters of the violence and the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. So we accompany the kindergartners through a checkpoint, and it's just amazing. You get to be like the engine or the caboose, and then you've got the train in between, or you get to be Mama Duckling and all the ducklings following you. You all know the drill, right?
Yeah.
It's so amazing. One day I did the school run with the kindergartners, and when I got back to the office, I was inputting the numbers, you know, of how many kids I had accompanied that day. And then I checked my email, and there was a message from a friend who said, "Chris, check out the statement that Jewish Voices for Peace just published about the Movement for Black Lives platform statement about Palestine."
Oh.
It's like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish Voice for Peace giving the full affirmative endorsement of the Black Lives Matter platform about Palestine. I was like, talk about movement of movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
The very next day, I'm online again, and I see a link to an article someone else sent me. And I click on the link, and it was a delegation of Palestinian youth who had just arrived at Standing Rock to stand in solidarity with the Lakota Sioux water protectors.
Yeah,
it's happening. We're beginning to see, and we're beginning to experience. Like Dr. King said, we're all knit together in one. You know, I don't remember how I put it. The one indivisible garment or something, right? And that injustice to one piece of the community is injustice to all pieces of the community. So, just to circle back to my original statement, I'm a recruiter for a little movement, a mini movement that's going to play a part within this larger movement ecology, this larger movement of movements. A lot of what we're about is described in this book, not all of it, and some folks within this mini movement would describe it differently, would take some of this out and add something different, but this book will give you a pretty good sense of the conversations we're having. So I invite you to consider for yourself how you relate to this way of looking at nonviolence, and also to consider those in your life that you think might, you know, feel a resonance with this approach, because it's time for us to get the family together. Sooner the better. I think many of us probably heard at the beginning of winter, temperatures in the Arctic were 36 degrees hotter than normal. 36 degrees. You know, what the scientists have been telling us, it's showing to be very, very true, terrifyingly true. So, we don't know how that's going to play out. I love how Joanna Macy talks about that. We don't know how this is going to play out, but what an amazing time to be alive. So, I think that's pretty much what I had to share. I'm really happy to be with you all. Thanks so much for being so present with me as I talked, and I'm happy now to field a couple of questions or comments, too. Yes, please.
I love the book. I got to read it a while back. And there's a section in there that I wanted to see if you'd expound on a little bit more. And that's the question, what about Hitler? Recently, another book I've read by Gabriel Cousins. It's called Living Peace by Being Peace. And he talks about how sometimes one does not recognize the right of another to exist. And sometimes that is the place where there's nothing more one can do except meet that force. And Do you want to talk about that a little more? Because I was trying to pull out a little more that you wrote about the, what about Hitler, and really understand that piece.
Yeah, that was one of the most challenging parts for me to wrestle with. I should put that in the present tense. That is one of the most challenging parts for me to wrestle with. Just looking for, what about Hitler? Integrity forces me to go there, but in the face of the immeasurable violence, inflicted suffering in our world, past, present, and future, I do so with a profound sense of inadequacy and a fear of pure insignificance. I just want to be honest that when I face into that question, that's how I feel. What I argue here in the book is what Gandhi said in different terms. When it comes to nonviolent resistance, we're like kindergartners. We're right at the beginning of learning how this force works, which puts us in a really precarious situation when you consider what we're up against right now. That's where that feeling of profound insignificance or sense of inadequacy comes from. I don't believe that we know how to wield enough nonviolent force to take on a Hiroshima at this stage in our development. Personally, I think that would be irresponsible of me to say, yeah, we're ready to counter that. I don't see it. So my hypothesis has been, well, then we got to start learning. We got to start getting serious about this. We need to start investing as much as we do into the military, into peace teams, and learning how to do this, into grassroots nonviolence education and so forth. And that's what I've been trying to do, and some of us have been trying to do. But I just feel a deep sense of humility in the face of the gargantuan violence that we face. Again, kind of leaning on our sister Joanna Macy, at the same time, I feel like movements make magical things happen. And I do believe that the potential resides in us for things that we could only dream of. And my hope is that the great turning, the shift that we're talking about, that's why it's an epochal shift. That's why she thinks it's on par with something like the agrarian revolution or the industrial revolution. It's a shift that major. But this one, she says, needs to happen very rapidly, not over the course of generations. It needs to happen over the course of a few years. And it needs to be deliberate in a way that those others weren't. And it represents a massive shift in consciousness. And that's where I draw some hope that things are going to emerge that we're not used to because they come from a completely different paradigm. The other thing I would say in response, and then we'll see about a couple other questions, is that I don't judge people who choose violence in the face of that violence. My experience and my intuition tells me that this great turning is going to happen if enough of us do that critical work of self-transformation, that work of aligning principle and practice, meaning that we dive deeply enough into the very center of our heart of hearts and have a brutally honest conversation with ourselves there about what we believe to be most true about being a human being, what we believe to be most true about our being here on the planet at this time, and then moving in action from that depth of understanding. I think if enough of us do that, then we'll finally model for one another what nonviolence actually is in a way that hasn't happened yet, in a way that Gandhi's movement didn't show us, in the way that the movement that King was spokesperson for didn't show us. We got glimmers of it, but I think they would be the first to admit they were just scratching the surface of what was possible. I also believe that that level of inquiry, I'm doubtful that people, if they did that level of inquiry, would choose violence. So I hope enough of us are willing to go there. That's at least the beginning of a response to what you're raising. I really appreciate the question and keep wrestling with it.
Thank you.
Please.
So you talked about practices, and the more I dive into these movements that had such depth, it was practices that people did together, spiritual practices. If you think of the Quakers and Thich Nhat Hanh's resistance to the Vietnam War and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship that Joanna Macy comes from. There were practices that helped them not only in that self-transformation, but it wasn't always individual. It was often done in community and in a group.
Right.
So do you offer practices in the movement?
I don't offer practices in the sense of like a prescription, but I definitely talk about an array of practices that people have made incredible use of. And I argue that it really is up to each of us to figure out which recipe is going to work for us. I really appreciate, though, that you're bringing in the communal aspect of it. This isn't just something that we go off into a cave to do by ourselves, at least not for many of us. And I'm also glad you brought it up, because usually when scholars of Gandhi will talk about the self-purification part, the self-transformation aspect, they'll point to his spiritual disciplines, fasting and prayer, repetition of the mantra, the various things that he used. I sort of play with that a little bit, because I think that the self-transformation, if you really read across Gandhi's literature, you see that he's talking about self-transformation as a much sort of more comprehensive thing, that I actually believe that those spiritual disciplines are actually fuel for self-purification and self-transformation. And that we see that self-transformation in Gandhi just as much in watching his, for example, his relationship with clothing. How, as a student in Britain, he's wearing a three-piece suit, even a top hat, and walking with a cane for a little while to mimic his idealized version of the British gentleman. Then the loincloth, that process of self-transformation, of aligning practice and principle, he ends up with the loincloth. Similarly, his home in South Africa was a two-story brick house just a few doors down from the Attorney General. He was living large. The end of his life, he's living in a mud hut, like the poorest of the poor. So those aren't spiritual disciplines, but to me they're evidence of this deep transformation for which those spiritual disciplines were the fuel, I think. That's my reading. And that has a lot to do also with my own experience. Mm-hmm. That when I have those practices, when I'm in sync with those practices in my daily life, it's so much easier for me to let go of the encumbrances. That's what I found. So thank you for that. Yeah, I don't have like a prescription, but I definitely play with those ideas and offer up at least some examples of what people have drawn from. Yes.
As you were leaving, I mentioned something to you about resistance to truth being like a chinning bar. Resistance to truth is truth itself demanding strength of itself. I said, resistance to truth is truth in disguise. This piece ends with, or is it only truth when it cannot be resisted? Only tell me, is it possible to tell the truth without making art? I don't even know. The challenge to our creativity, the challenge to asking the question, where is the art in this moment here? Mm. And the trust that it is there, and if you don't look for it, you won't find it. And what is involved is a courtship. It's a courtship. And it won't show its face to you. It won't give itself to you unless you court it well. So it's a study, it's a craft. And mostly it's an act of faith, and it's also an act of knowing, absolute knowing that it's there. And Piet Hein, a Scandinavian poet, he wrote these little poems called Brooks, and one of my favorite ones was, "The road to wisdom, well, it's plain and simple to express, to err and err and err again, but less and less and less." So a lot has to do with making them with conviction, making them passionately and stupidly and vulnerably.
I have something I'd like to share in response, and it's just a very brief story. I had the unbelievable opportunity of being mentored by a man named Vincent Harding, who some of you may know about. He was a close friend of Dr. King's, and on April 4th, he'll be honored along with Dr. King, because Dr. Harding was the author of the Beyond Vietnam speech that Dr. King gave 50 years ago on April 4th this year. I was invited to do a series of radio programs about the new Jim Crow after Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, came out, to explore mass incarceration and racism. And I went to Dr. Harding because as a white person in my organizing, I had never been in spaces with the vast majority of folks in the spaces I was about to enter were African Americans who had been incarcerated. I hadn't been in spaces like that before, or at least very little, and I was really nervous. I was straight up scared that I was going to make mistakes, that I was going to say the wrong thing, that I was, honestly, I was afraid I was going to be the wrong thing in those spaces. And I shared this with Dr. Harding, whose heart was as big as the universe. I don't know how else to say it. And he said to me in his beautiful, slow, gentle voice, "Chris, the sooner you get in there and start making those mistakes, the better." It was such a teaching for me. The book is dedicated to Vincent Harding and my daughter Issa. And my daughter Issa here. How about one last question? Is there any last burning desire for a question?
I have a comment.
Or a comment.
So I'm working on a documentary film about water, and that led me to Standing Rock. And when I got back, I found out that 20 plus members of my community down in San Luis Obispo had also been to Standing Rock. We got together, we did a community event so we could share stories with our community. And one of the gals, in her presentation, got up and held your book up high. And she said, "Before I even begin, you all need to read this book, and here's why." So that's how I heard about your book originally. And then I'm up here for a week working on my film, and Kate Bunny from Walking Water said, "You have to go to this talk tonight." And it was just meant to be, because I'd already heard about the book, and I'm already here, and I'm never here because I live like 6-7 hours away. So I just wanted to, you know, thank you and kind of give you that feedback.
Feels really good.
And that's a perfect example, the Standing Rock, of what's happening. You know, there are people coming together. I think the what's his name, winning the presidency has created so many communities.
I like that.
Much resistance and nonviolent resistance.
And Standing Rock kept coming up for me as you were speaking.
Definitely community.
Thank you. We need to close. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just quickly wanted to say, so much of what you're talking about reminds me of Al-Anon. I'm in Al-Anon. Mm. And a big part of Al-Anon is honoring ourselves and learning how to honor ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we come together as a group and honor each other.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Karisha, will you kindly close out this? Are you up for that? Yeah.
I feel inspired to share a song by our dear friend Lawrence Cole, and it's one I think that we can hop on to. It's a song called Let Things Ripen. So I'm not going to stand because I have a little solo here with me, but I'll sing through once and then or let things ripen. Let things ripen and then fall. Let's do even just that much together.
Let things ripen and then fall.
Next part.
Force is not the way at all. Force is not the way at all. Just let go, and you will see. Just let go, and you will see. The way to do is to be.
Many Rivers Books and Tea. I want to thank you all for coming tonight and point out, of course, that we have many copies of this book over here, and I'm sure he would be happy to sign books.
With whatever name you want.
There you go. What an offer. And we also have a donation bowl. Donations are welcome. We split the donations we receive with our speakers to further their work, and also retain half to maintain this space for further such events. So thank you all for coming tonight. Come and see us again for other events, or when the bookshelves are back here and you can see the other books. And enjoy this wonderful spring-like evening. Thank you.
My name's Kathleen. Really good to meet you. And Jean Farmer has loaned me her copy of your book. And